or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of November 6th, 2016. I'm sitting here looking at something where there was a label typed wrong in my studio. I'm Kurt Franklin, the executive editor for technical content at Information Week, and I'm joined this week by one of our regular guests and, of course, one of my favorites, senior editor at Dark Reading, Sarah Peters. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks for having me, Kurt. It's always a pleasure.
Well, this has been an exciting week, although not necessarily one that's been super exciting in the technology world. I mean, for those who might still be living under a rock, there was an election here in the U.S. this week. And from a technology standpoint, there were some fascinating things going on, and I'd like to talk about them with you. Would also love to hear from our listeners. So if you're listening to us live, go ahead and let us know what you think about these issues we're going to be bringing up, because we're going to be talking about technology as it related to the election. And the first thing I want to talk about is the hacking that didn't happen. You know, before the election, we kept hearing about this army of usually Russian hackers that were waiting to dive into our voting machines and corrupt them, that were waiting to disrupt the electoral process here in the U.S. And it didn't seem to happen. Now, Sarah, first of all, let me ask, you keep a much closer look at security than I do. Did it in fact happen and we just didn't hear about it?
Well, if it did happen, we didn't hear about it either. The Dark Reading team was, we were all keeping ourselves awake, not just to watch election results, but also to see if we would hear news of that kind of thing so that we could report on it. And we haven't heard of anything like that. We have heard of attacks coming after the fact, spear phishing attacks from the same Russian nation state backed hackers that attacked the Democratic National Committee, post election attacks, but nothing on the election, the voting systems themselves.
Well, that we know now, of. From that point of view, is this something that was always overblown as a threat, or do you think it's a case where there was a legitimate threat out there and for whatever reasons the officials, the U.S. officials, were able to keep it from happening? I mean, was this like the Y2K thing where everybody got so worried about it and prepared for it, so it ended up not being the kind of problem it could have been?
I think it's always something that they worry about. But I think I don't think it was a complete we say Y2K was this thing that we all worried about so much, and then it was a non-factor because, of course, nothing happened, and we all were almost as though we were all wishing for the whole world to explode. And because it didn't, oh, it was all just a farce. But I think that ultimately the reason that somebody, a foreign entity or anybody, would want to disrupt an election would either be to change the results or to just disrupt the democratic process, to disrupt the democracy itself, to unsettle a country. Anybody here would argue right now that our democracy is not quite all that settled right now. I think there's a lot of unrest here. There's a lot of protests going on of all different kinds, and it's just been like that all week. It's been like that all year. I think that even without hacking, simply the threat of one threat of it was enough to kind of do the job to begin with. Also, just the political landscape that we've had, the talk about all of the talk leading up to the election about the fact that the election was going to be rigged and that things were going to be miscounted, and all of those statements made that were kind of putting question marks in people's heads about whether or not the votes were going to be counted correctly. I think that kind of does the job already. That's almost like, why would you bother hacking? But yeah, the election officials were given briefs multiple times by people at the Department of Homeland Security for months leading up to this, in order to better prepare them and prepare those systems against a variety of different kinds of attacks. Because I do think that there are legitimate threats from, especially when we're looking at the kind of major, some of the huge like denial of service attacks that we've seen coming out just in the past couple months. When you see the scope of some of those things, I think that there were legitimate reasons to worry that the voting systems could have really been in trouble on Tuesday.
Well, now you brought up something in your answer there that I'd love to pursue a little bit more. When you talked about the briefings, when you talked about the worry, the concern, and the unsettled nature of politics in the U.S., from what you're seeing, are people remaining on high alert? Are you hearing about officials and even security teams at some of our larger companies, say financial institutions or such, that are remaining on high alert even though the election is over now? Do you think that they're, from an IT security perspective, remains a threat even at this point?
Yeah, definitely. Because, well, first of all, whenever there is strife of any kind, cyber attackers follow. There's research been done that cyber attackers both follow that kind of geopolitical and economic strife, and can also cause that kind of geopolitical strife because you can profit off of it. If you send out a spearfishing message right now that is related to the election, it's the kind of thing, it's a lure that is going to grab people's attention because of their own feelings. And although the election happened and it's, you know, there wasn't any evidence of tampering with anything, that doesn't mean that the whole thing is behind us, right? There's still a lot happening. There's still very, very high emotions around everything. So there's still an opportunity for attackers to draw on all of that, on all of that good stuff. So absolutely, there's that. There's something for them to profit off of, for one. And then two, because there's so much, some politically motivated attackers, you don't always really know what their motivations are, right? So you always have to wonder whatever it is that they're going to be going after. If we're in a period right now where our country is going through, it's certainly going through a transition, because we're going from one administration to another. And that's the generous way of putting it, is that's going through a transition. We're certainly in a period of upheaval. That makes us vulnerable. just from the technological standpoint of we've got a shift of staff. The White House staff is going to have all of their all of those identities, all of that, you know, identity and access management system, all of those you know, usernames and passwords are going to have to be changed. All of that administration stuff is going to have to be taken care of really carefully. And during that change management process, there's a lot of vulnerabilities involved in that. There's a lot of, if you get the wrong thing, if you allow one little mistake during that process, somebody's going to be waiting and looking for that one little mistake. And this is a very, very dangerous time, even if it wasn't, if it was just a regular run of the mill election, which this one certainly was not. So I would say, yes, everybody's on high alert.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're on high alert here and things are unsettled here. But there is another country that I've been following a little bit that is having more uncertainty than we are even. A lot of people don't realize it, but one of the most technologically advanced governments around is Estonia. Estonia is a very highly digital government, and Estonia is actually the home of any number of high-tech firms. Skype, originally, I believe, came out of Estonia. And the government of Estonia has just pretty much collapsed. There's been a no-confidence vote in parliament, so they're going to have a new prime minister. NATO has based a lot of troops and airplanes there because it's right up next to Russia. And it's interesting to see this sort of unsettled political and economic thing that we get very wrapped up around in the U.S. playing out across other parts of the world as well. It's easy for us to forget that there are other places in the world that are affected by all of these things. But
I wonder what that's going to mean for all those e-citizens in Estonia, because Estonia has that fascinating digital citizenship program.
They really do, and it's been especially interesting for companies that wanted to do what is essentially the same thing as cargo ships that are registered in either Panama or Liberia because of regulations and protections in those two nations. People were becoming digital citizens of Estonia to take advantage of protections offered to citizens there. This could be a big deal. This is one of those small countries that we don't think about a whole lot that could end up having a big impact. And Sarah, I wanted to ask a question. You know, we were talking about the idea of the Russian hackers and the threats.
Mm-hmm.
In looking so hard at one country, Russia, do you think that a lot of people have been ignoring threats from other actors out there? Are there, from where you sit, are there other sources of threats that we should be paying more attention to, that where the whole Russia thing has sort of distracted us?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because we do end up talking about the Russian hackers all the time. They're certainly not the only nation state backed hackers out there. It's just they've been coming up a lot lately because although there are hackers everywhere, I mean, literally everywhere, and also nation state backed groups all over the place. Certainly China and Korea and the Middle East and in the, you know, it throughout Europe, throughout South America, they're everywhere. And here, obviously. The Russian groups are, the cyber espionage is kind of their specialty. And that's why those groups are the ones that have been coming up in conversation so often recently. It's because that's what their strength is. That ability to, what's the word for it? That psychological operations, that ability to change the way people think about things, that is something that Russian intelligence agencies have been really great at for a very, very, very long time. And it's something that has been passed along down to the hacking groups, from what I have been told. And that's something that was used in campaigns to try to disrupt foreign governments in Ukraine and, you know, press their advantage throughout that region. And maybe in Estonia for now that I come to think of it, I'm not sure. But I have to talk to my contact in Estonia and ask him about that. It's just happens to be that's kind of their specialty. That's why they come up all the time. So if you think that if you have forgotten about all of the other hackers in the world, then I'm sorry about that. But no, they're not the only ones. They're not the only ones we have to worry about.
Well, that's not encouraging. That's not encouraging, really. Although, you know, I suppose the real lesson here is that there is now no time when we can afford to ignore IT security. And there is no direction that we can afford to turn our gaze away from. You know, we really do need to be looking at the idea of nefarious actors coming at us from pretty much any part of the world. And I don't know that I see anything either economically or politically that's going to change that anytime soon. I mean, am I missing some great wellspring of good news that's out there? Do you have words that can make us all feel warm and cozy on this Friday afternoon?
No, I'm sorry. I wish I did, but...
Well, darn.
I don't. I don't have a lot of good news to offer on this.
All right. Well, you know, let's turn then our gaze from this whole bubbling cesspool of bad news and look for a few minutes at another source of bad news. And this is something else that was sort of our awareness of it, at least, was heightened around the election. And that is the whole notion of analytics and trust. Because one of the things at Information Week that we've heard fairly often throughout the last couple of months, it's been coming up more and more, is that while companies are investing more and more heavily in business analytics, business executives, especially those in the C-suite, have less and less confidence in the analysis that these systems are providing. And that seems like a conundrum or a paradox, because they're spending more on something that they don't believe. And, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that, including the whole checkbox syndrome, that they feel like their boards would ask questions if they weren't spending money on this thing that everyone's talking about. But in the election, there were a lot of people who were, frankly, somewhere between surprised and shocked at the results because they felt that they had seen analysis that indicated the results would be different. Now, I know that there were some folks out there. One of the people that I tend to think highly of when it comes to statistical analysis is Nate Silver. And he was tended to be a bit more conservative. And he also explained his methodology, which I think was important. And the question, though, is, has the election and the results dealt a serious blow to analytics in general use in this country? Do you think that whether we're talking about business analytics or your specialty, security analytics, people are going to be more skeptical about the numbers coming out of systems following what happened this week? What do you think?
Yeah, I do. I feel like to some degree, people rely, some of us in, and I say stats like security stats, political stats, stats about what's going on in your network, baseball stats, whatever it is. And they think that they know everything there is to know, and they take that at face value too often, without trying to put it into context. And there's so many times, and Kurt, you are a journalist, you know this yourself, that there's times that you would really love to, you'd love to have a graphic designer with you to put a beautiful visual rendering of something to go along with your story, because it would really help. But then you also know that there's those times that somebody would only look at that image and would never read any of your words. They would never look at the context. They'd only look at the numbers and the picture. And it's very frustrating when we start relying only on those stats. The way that I always tell it to people when I'm talking about basketball is that looking at stats is not a substitution for watching the game. It's helpful to really dig into the stats, to give yourself another perspective on something, to see what you might have missed, to look for a pattern that maybe you couldn't see at the speed of the game. But it's not a substitute for actually watching things go by. And I think that, yeah, we might have, sometimes we get so enamored with our own modeling systems that we stop, we overly trust them. And I think that does a disservice to us.
You know, it,
I mean,
it's
what do
fascinating.
You think?
Well, I think that, as you say, we have become trained to look at the image, to look at the what I'll call the top level numbers, and not dive any deeper. And I think especially for journalists, now this is a soapbox I have gotten on at gatherings of journalists. If we don't have either the willingness or the intellectual tools to burrow down into those numbers, then we do our readers and listeners a disservice, because basically we're left in the position of being nothing more than public relations mouthpieces if we can't get beneath that top level of numbers. But even for most citizens, you know, we've gone through two decades now of educational reform, where we kept trying to tell people that, you know, we want our students to be better prepared for the real world. And yet, one of the areas where I think we fail our students is that we don't do enough with statistics, because statistics are going to be used by people trying to convince us of things. Now, whether these are scientists or marketers or politicians, whatever it is, they will use statistics. And if we don't understand what the words mean quite precisely and how numbers are generated quite precisely, then once again, we are at the mercy of those who would use these statistics to deceive us. There's an old saying, there are liars, damned liars in statistics, or lies, damned lies in statistics. And, you know, a lot of people in the world of academics and statistics will tell you that you can, with a little work, generate statistics that will give you the results you want. That's one of the reasons why in academic papers, one of the most crucial aspects is listing exactly how you generated the numbers that you use.
Mm-hmm.
But so that people can go back and check. I think that we really do need in business, in academia, in the general population, and especially in the press, to go back and re-educate ourselves in statistics, because they are used all the time. And here's going to be a plug. If you are used to seeing these charts, these lovely graphics that companies throw out there to try and show you in a nutshell what the statistics are, there's a book that everyone needs to have on their bookshelf. It's called The Visual Display of Quantitative Information.
Ooh.
It's by...
Nighttime reading.
Well, here's the thing. It's by a gentleman whose last name is Tufte, T-U-F-T-E. He actually wrote three books.
Cute.
That was the first one. And it is beautiful. It is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very educational in terms of how the graphics can be used to deceive us. And on the flip side, how to design your own graphics so that they will not deceive other people. It's really something that I recommend highly to people. And, you know, his name is Edward Tufte. He's still alive. And he has written, let's see, four books. Wow. They're all great. And I'm going to go at Information Week, if you're listening to this on a podcast or on a recorded version, come on over to Information Week in the site of the radio show, because I'm putting a link to his website as part of the conversation. And I hope that everyone will go and take a look at it. It's a series of books that I've had on my bookshelf for a long time. And I hope that people will go use these to educate yourself about images and statistics.
I want to check it out myself.
Well, you know, as hard as it is to believe, we've used up pretty much all of our time today. Sarah, you and I have a tendency to do that when we're together on this show. we get going and rolling on a topic or two and find ourselves running out of time before we run out of interesting things to say. But I do want to give you a chance to tell us what you're working on over at Dark Reading, what's coming up, and you know, what people should be looking from you and maybe from the rest of the Dark Reading crew over there?
Well, I'm working on a piece about the that's kind of a wrap up of the big denial of service attacks we've seen this year. One of our freelancers, Jay Vijayan, is I just finished editing a really cool piece from him about it's a wrap up of some of the biggest government breaches over the past several years. That's not going to be up until Tuesday, but I'd keep my eyes peeled for that one. And also on Tuesday, we have the Dark Reading virtual event that I think is going to be really, really cool. So head on over to darkreading.com and look for more information on that, because we've got some really great speakers. Bruce Schneier is going to be one of our keynoters, so that's kind of amazing. And yeah, you can find out more there.
Well, anytime you can get Bruce talking about stuff, that's special. That's worth making special plans to hear, because I don't think I have ever heard him speak when it wasn't absolutely worthwhile. And speaking of worthwhile, I know that following you on Twitter is one of those worthwhile things. How can people do that?
Well, you can find me at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. As for me, I'm writing frequently at Information Week. I have a piece coming up on languages for developing applications on the web. Also working hard on this podcast series that we've started and that we're now up to our 10th episode on, Information Week's Expert Voices. I'm really having a lot of fun doing these because I'm getting to talk to some very interesting people, people who are actually out there making IT happen for their organizations. So these are lessons that are coming to us from our peers. This isn't somebody doing marketing speak. This isn't somebody off in an ivory tower. This is someone who is hands-on, making things happen, and willing to talk about how they did it, how they're making the decisions, how they're deciding on the technology they're using, and what they have to do within the organization to make IT a reality. So please check out Information Week's Expert Voice on iTunes, on Google Play, or at Information Week, because it's available all of those places. You can find my latest stuff. I will generally talk about it on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. And look forward to having the conversations with you at informationweek.com or on Twitter. Well, you'll find us back here next week on Information Week Live. We hope that you'll join us. If you are listening to this on a streaming or podcast version, thank you. But we happen every week live at 3 p.m. Eastern here at informationweek.com. We'd love to have you join us. There is a live chat that happens alongside the show, and we'd love to have your voice in that live chat. We're always watching that, seeing if there are things that need to come into the show. We'd love to have your voice there. Well, for Sarah Peters, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. And hey, we'll see you next week.